Psalm 87 now. The psalmist delights in Jerusalem as having been founded by Yahweh. Because Yahweh has set up his abode there, Jerusalem is portrayed, and this is most exceptional, it's unique in the Psalms, as the mother city of even traditional enemies. Egypt, you know why that's a traditional enemy. Babylon, Philistia, the three key, constantly recurring enemies of Israel. And the psalm will portray them coming to the city to look for God. So it's a very Catholic psalm, extraordinarily. It's a rare insight anywhere in the Bible to find, Old Testament Bible to find this. But here it is. So let's go through this psalm 87. He has set it up on a holy mountain. Well, there's plenty of similar statements about God's founding Zion on the mountain. In fact, in the tradition, it was the same mountain of when Abraham sacrificed the lamb. That's how mentally that's included in here too. This is the holy mountain. Plenty of evidence of that. So he has set it up on a holy mountain. Yahweh prefers the gates of Zion to all the dwellings of Jacob. So it's written by a Jew, clearly, a Judahite. So Shechem and Bethel and Shiloh and Dan and Bathsheba, wherever else, you know. This is the favorite dwelling place of God. Later it will become the only dwelling place. So the others had to all come there. It's a bit iffy, all that. This is the one they didn't allow any sacrifices to be anywhere, and they called them all high places and tried to get rid of them. And that sounds awfully political to me, but there we are. Here, he prefers the gates of Zion to all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. Very proud of the city and good that he is. In Psalm 48 echoes some of this. Great is Yahweh, greatly to be praised in the city of our God. His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of all the earth, Mount Zion, in the far north, city of the great king. Now the bit that is so surprising, verse 4, God speaking, I number Egypt and Babylon among those who recognize me. Now this is in the face of plenty of material that says, you know, they've got false gods and they're enemies and they're our enemies, so they're God's enemies. This person somehow transcends all that extraordinarily. I number Egypt and Babylon among those who recognize me, Yahweh. Philistines, people of Tyre in the north, and Cush, Egypt, southern Egypt, are born there. And of Zion it shall be said, that one and that one were born there. The Most High himself has set it up or established it. There's going to be a time when everyone will look to Jerusalem as the mother city. And if you become a Roman Catholic, you might think, yeah, Rome, you know, the similar mentality in a way, doing that. It's dangerous, but it's something in it as well. So, Jerusalem is portrayed as a fruitful mother, including among her children nations traditionally considered enemies. In this extraordinarily Catholic verse, they're numbered as citizens. And I'll give you just a few texts that have a little bit of the same feeling in them, but I had to look hard to find them. They're quite rare. Zechariah 2:11 reads, many nations shall join themselves to Yahweh on that day and shall be my people, and I will dwell in your midst. You can again imagine Paul. That would stand out for him once he saw what Jesus was on about. Isaiah 14:1, aliens will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. Foreigners will come in and be part of the family. Isaiah 56:6, foreigners join themselves to Yahweh to minister to him, to love the name of Yahweh and to be his servants. little inklings of a dream that they had. And here in our Psalm 87 verse 6, Yahweh will write in the register of the peoples. Now, cities had their registers, citizens' registers. They weren't registering the slaves or whatever else, but in that kind of democracy that we talk about from Greece, it was democratic if you belonged to the top quarter of the population, but if you weren't anywhere near it. But at least there was some beginnings of a demos, of a people making decisions. Well, they had the register of peoples. And in Yahweh's writing, this one was born there, the ones that God's chosen. But as we've seen, even from Egypt, Babylon, Philistia, I don't know how this psalm would have been welcomed or received. I don't know how it stayed. I don't know how it survived. But it did survive. So there's one of these little insights in there. Again, a couple of texts that might pick up some of that. Isaiah chapter 2 reads, "In days to come," is the dream, "the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All nations shall stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, 'Come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths.'" And again, Isaiah 66, "I'm coming to gather all nations and all tongues, and they shall come and see my glory, and all flesh shall come and worship before me, says Yahweh." And a few more, because I've almost given you the lot that I can find, but there we are. Psalm 102 will read, "So that the name of Yahweh may be declared in Zion and his praise in Jerusalem, when peoples gather together and kingdoms to worship Yahweh." So do you see, they're keeping alive that idea that Abram will be the father of many nations. And while it wasn't happening, they kept dreaming that it would happen. Some of them kept dreaming. Others locked themselves into ethnic cleansing and all the rest of it. And Zechariah 8:22 reads, "Many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favour of Yahweh." Now, the nearest text to Psalm 87 in the Old Testament scripture is a late text, and it's speaking of the Egypt of the Ptolemies. This is after Alexander the Great. Ptolemy was one of his generals, and he took the southern part in Egypt. And Seleucus was another of Alexander's generals, and he took all the north part. And poor Israel was firstly with the Ptolemies for about 100 years, and then it swept up and became part of the north. So it was a fight between the two, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, who owned this corridor, important corridor, for military movement. So here we have in Isaiah 19, verse 23 to 25, and I hope we haven't studied Isaiah with you, but I hope you realize Isaiah is a scroll, and some of it no doubt goes right back to Isaiah. So that's 740 to 700 BC. But then it gets added to and added to and added to and added to right through till nearly the time of Jesus, I think, or 200 BC or 300 BC. In other words, it's a bit, to me, the best image I can get to it is as though you had an anthology of, say, Jesuit writings. So you've got Ignatius of Loyola, but then you've got all the other Ignatian writings that come in into the scroll of Ignatius, or the Franciscan.
Just keeps growing.
Yeah, it just keeps growing because of the disciples who are consistent with it, keep going. Well, that's the book of Isaiah. And it's often hard to work out when different parts of it, what part they played and when they came in and all that. But the scholars tell me, and I believe them, Isaiah 19, 23 to 25 is a late text. And it reads, "On that day there'll be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrians will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. On that day Israel will be a third, with Israel and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom Yahweh of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people. Extraordinary. And Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage. So Israel will be the binding force, the link, who will bring about a union between these great ever-warring nations of Assyria and Egypt. And where they're the peacemakers, Shalom, they're the ones that will bring the whole world together to know Yahweh, and they'll all belong, and we'll be the kind of the key, the link. Well, can you imagine, why would you be surprised that Christians who cottoned on to what Jesus was on about then made this whole new energy that we call the church, the Christian community, Catholic, universal community, because that's what it was. That was going to be the dream. And in a way, the dream is amazingly being fulfilled, isn't it? 1,000 million Catholic Christians in our world, and then you've got a heck of a lot of other Christians who are different degrees of communion, and so Christianity ought to be exactly what that says. Can be, and the people from all nations of the world can come here to Mass and know what's happening and be part of it and come to communion. Wouldn't it be lovely if the whole world was disciples of Jesus and worshipped the God that Jesus taught us about? Then all the best of Islam would be gathered up into, all the best of Buddhism would be gathered up, all the best of the Hindu world, all the Upanishads and the Vedas and all this stuff would all be gathered up into one community, because there's only one world, one flock, one shepherd. It's a dream, but it's our dream. So we've got to keep this dream alive. And when people want to make the Catholic Church strong, rigid, with what do you call it, fences around it, so that everyone can recognise it, well, blow them. Take no blooming notice of it. It's awful. And it's cutting across the dream of Jesus. Go and baptise all nations. So it doesn't mean we become everything and anything. It doesn't matter what we believe. It's not talking about that. But we have to be open to absolutely everyone and embrace everyone and welcome their gifts, their way of worshipping, their way of thinking, their theology. There's not one theology, for heaven's sake. There are truths and not truths. And it matters that we have words that face us to the mystery and that we oppose words that tempt walk away from the mystery. But there's a million ways of facing the mystery according to your culture and your understanding, and whether you're a man or a woman, you're going to look at it differently, aren't you? And we're all going to have different, but they'll all be consistent with this Jesus understanding of God as Abba and the total universal love of God and God's all-embracing care. It has to be consistent with that. If it's not consistent with that, well, you're back into error. You're back into forgetting what Jesus was on about. But it's terribly easy for our religion to become culturally specific and proud. And so we come to the feast we just had on Sunday 2 days ago. That's what this is about. The universality realised on the day of Pentecost. Here in our church, nearly all foreigners here, I see, but here in our church I had a little simple thing whereby they acted out the Book of Acts, and they had five or six flames, torches, and then they spread out through the church, and then different people from different communities that are represented here, and there's many, of course, the Sri Lankan, Dutch, German, Italian, Polish, Russian, etc., etc., got up in the church and just said the same words in their own language. It was like a jumble of sound. Oh, that's lovely.
Particularly after the flames were there in the beginning, up near the altar, a lady rattled those things that made the pretty
noise. Oh, yeah.
The
sound, what do you call those things when the wind blows in, they go.
She rattled, and then from the back, and I thought, what's happened there? A child doing something. Yeah. And from the back of the church, somebody said, what's that noise? And that was the beginning of that. It was very
good. Well, that's nice, yeah. So that's a simple. And then they read out, they changed the words of this, and they read out the nationalities. Vietnamese was another, that were in our actual church. The Japanese was another. So we had quite a... So here, let's go back to this text. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, these were the people of the local area. Residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, the parts of Libya around Cyrene, the visitors from Rome, Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, in our own languages, we hear them speaking about God's deeds of power. And of course they, well, as I suggested in the homily, or I suppose said in the homily, it wasn't as if people understood other people's languages. You don't understand other people's languages. The point is that all the different people that were speaking their different languages were all speaking the one message, they were saying the one thing, God is love. And in loving, it transcended differences of language and reversed the Tower of Babel. That's the story. Tower of Babel, which you know that story. People were trying to build their own way up to God, the tower, and you can't do that. It has to be welcomed. And God's way of stopping it was to create all these different languages. That's a little naive story, of course. So you've got all these, now they can't understand each other, so they can't work together to build their way up to God. And then what happens at Pentecost? It's all reversed. All the different languages are no longer a barrier, because they're all speaking the one language. They're all speaking love. Oh, how beautiful, yes. God came down to us. Yeah, how beautiful. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you. Why didn't you get up and add that to the homily? Yes, God came down to us, the flames, and we weren't building our own way up. Beautiful.
Wind chimes.
Wind chimes, yeah.
So very far away from that wonderful utopia.
We are away from it.
Look at
us. Yeah. We all have to look at our own lives, our own communities, our own parishes, our own preaching. It's a constant thing, and it is constant. And thank God it's going on. The world is as good as it is because so many people are doing it. It's as bad as it is because so many aren't. And God doesn't control the world, so God's waiting on us to welcome the fire. Here's Paul. I'm going to give the last word to Paul. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 12 to 19. The universal scope of God's love. And I understand Paul's letter to the Ephesians as his final farewell as he thought at the time, to the people in the East before he went off to Rome. My hunch is that he wrote it in Caesarea in that 2-year period when before he was taken to Rome, and he's saying farewell to all these lovely Gentile people. And he says, remember you Gentiles, you non-Jews, were at that time without the Messiah. You are aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of the promise. You had no hope. You were without God. It's the only time in the Bible, the New Testament, we have the word atheist. Atheos, you were without God in the world. But now, he says to these people that he'd missioned to all his life, in Christ Jesus, Paul's favourite expression, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, by the life, and that's what we receive in the Eucharist, of course. That's the blood we receive, by the life-giving, life poured out, love poured out of Jesus from the cross. For he is our peace. That's our psalm, you see. He's the one that links us all. Not Zion, not the physical Zion or the temple. I'm the temple, Jesus. Jesus is the one that links Egypt and Babylon and all the rest. He is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one, Jew and Gentile, and broken down the dividing wall, the hostility between us. And in the wall that Paul, and that's why Paul was put in prison in Caesarea, there was a wall in the Jerusalem temple which had, beyond this point, no Gentiles, keeping the Gentiles out and the Jews in. And they accused Paul of taking Titus, was it Titus? Anyway, one of them, it wasn't Titus, someone else, taking this non-Jew in beyond that wall. They were lying, of course, they were using it as an excuse. It wasn't true, he hadn't done it. But they accused him of that, and that's why he got shoved into prison and so on. So he knew a lot about this dividing wall, but he's saying the dividing wall doesn't exist anymore. There's no in and out. He has abolished the Torah with its commandments and ordinances. That's the lot. It's all abolished. Not because it was no good, but because it's arrived. You would abolish the scaffolding once you've built the house. You're going to leave the scaffolding there forever. You've painted the blooming guttering, so you abolish this. It's got you. You're on the roof. You've arrived. It's all there. So it's kind of done its work. It's come to a point. So, and it was necessarily culturally specific stuff, like take even the Ten Commandments, which are mostly common sense, and they're all over the place, including the Code of Hammurabi, you know, murder, violence, sexual abuse, and all. I mean, they're never going to be any good anywhere, so that's all right. But keep holy the Sabbath day, that's gone. We keep repeating it, and then we sneak it in, and the sisters tell us it's really now the Sunday. Do you know what I mean? But that's all just iffy. And the third commandment is gone. It's abolished. You don't keep holy the Sabbath day, particularly meaning set it aside as a special day for worship of God. We don't. If we were Jews, we would, and Jewish Christians, we would, but we're not. So we have the Sunday. And so you can go right through it all. The circumcision, certain foods, kosher foods, etc., etc. He's abolished that. Not that he's abolished it for Jews. If they want to do it, it's wonderful. You can say the rosary if you want to. You can wear a scapular medal if you want to. You can pray to Our Lady of Perpetual Succor if you want to. I mean, no one's going to stop you. But we're not going to make a command out of it. He abolished the law. It's not a law. It's a way. It's commandments and ordinances that he might create in himself one new humanity. There's a utopia, your dream, in place of the two. Thus making peace. And might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. We all, the Romans and the Jews, murdered Jesus. We all showed how sinful we all are, and he loved us all. So let's climb down from our power and embrace each other, and let the grace come to us. Let the fire come to us. So he came and he proclaimed peace to you who were far off and peace to those who were near. For through him both of us have access in one spirit to the Father. That's our access to the Father, through the one spirit. It's the experience of the Spirit that binds us together. The spirit of the experience of the Spirit takes us to Jesus, who is the icon of God, the human expression of God, the incarnation of God, the Word of God made flesh, all of that. So the Spirit is the Spirit of Jesus, his love. That's what binds us together. That's our experience. That takes us to Jesus, and he points to the transcendent mystery that he called Abba, God. So then, you're no longer strangers and aliens. You are citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. And there's a fair bit of Psalm 87 in that. If you look, so conclude our psalm, the last words, dancing they will sing, you are the source of all that we are. So the whole world will dance, the cosmic dance. Now those words, you are the source of all that we are, if you go to Rome and you speak Latin, the words are inscribed on the baptistry of John Lateran in Rome. John Lateran is the cathedral of Rome. No, the Vatican isn't. The cathedral is John Lateran. That was the earliest church, the mother of all churches, given by public churches. Constantine the Lateran was his wife's dowry, and was on the edge of the city in those days. Constantine was sensible not to give any central part to the Christians, because that would have caused a riot. So he gave them this, what's her name, Fluvia, I think. I know it, but it won't come to my little aging, senile brain. But out on the edge of the city was this John Lateran, and he also gave the Christians his mother's estate, which was the Santa Croce, the Holy Cross, right out near the wall of the city. They're both near the wall of the city, on the edges, in other words. But they're beautiful places, and they built them into these churches, and then the churches were now able to be public from then on. And there it is in the baptistry, inviting Christians into the community of that ancient, ancient church of John Lateran. We read, "You are the source of all that we are." We think of the spring of Ezekiel 47, verse 1 to 12, coming from the right side of the temple, the water pouring out. We think of the water pouring out from Jesus' side on the cross, which of course John has in mind, Ezekiel, where he pierced his, from the right side came out blood and water. And all the other beautiful texts. So Jesus is the one who binds the whole world together. or welcomes everyone into this community.